Welcome to another scrumptious edition of the Thursday Brunch. I'm Michelle Loxton in for Suzanne Radford while she's away. This week we've brought around the Dubai Today studio table three experts who are ready to talk chocolate and its savory qualities. Arva Ahmed is the chief executive muncher at Frying Pan Adventures. I know she's no stranger to the world of chocolate, having done research before about a chocolate trail. I remember her talking about a little while back. Arva, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Andre Gershel is the director of operations at a restaurant that has a very simple food philosophy: local, organic, fresh, homemade, and of course, they're no stranger to chocolate, of course. They're Baker and Spice, and he is Andre. Welcome, Andre.
Thank you so much. Great to be back. Big fan of the show. Big fan of chocolate.
Aren't we all? Well, actually, maybe there is somebody in the studio that isn't, and it's sweet qualities. We'll talk about that in the show today. And last but certainly not least, the man that brought about this savory and chocolate conversation when I visited him at his restaurant recently. Head chef James MacDonald is the man behind Cocoa Kitchen at CityWalk. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and I'm really excited to talk about chocolate and this great concept that we're going to talk about today.
Okay, so I want to start with you to talk about the ethos behind Cocoa Kitchen. So it's not just we love chocolate, we're putting it in our dishes. You have a very unique ethos behind what you're trying to do there in CityWalk.
Yes, we do. Exactly. It's just not like a concept where we just take some chocolate and some cocoa nibs and just throw it at the food and go, hey, this is it, you know. Obviously, we've all been to restaurants like that. But this one, we actually really think about it. We take the natural form of the chocolate, which is cocoa nibs, before it's made into chocolate. And this is where we start with. So we make our marinades from there, we grind it onto beef, and obviously we do the sweet side as well with the chocolate, which makes it a little bit more easier.
Now I'm going to bring Arva in, because I know that when I mentioned the show and said, Arva, do you want to come and join the show? And she's like, I'm not a lover of chocolate. Did you say something to this effect and we all fainted and had to recover from the statement?
I know, and it sounds even crazier, because we had, for some time, we were offering a limited edition chocolate tasting trail, which yes. I effectively lobbed off to my sister, who has much more of a sweet tooth and much more of an appreciation for chocolate. I think essentially what it is that through college, I just had very much of the junky sort of chocolate. Mm. You know, the chocolate lava cake, I won't even begin to take the name of the place from where I would get that from. Otherwise, I'll essentially lose two friends on the table today. Right, so I graduated from that into New York, and I think it reached a point where I had maybe overdone it. Like, it always seemed a little bit junky to me, and then as I sort of just matured, I think, a little bit. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just old age. I just started preferring sour things, like lemony things, like a lemon bar over a bar of chocolate, 100%. Any day. Like, I would pick it any day. It's just, I do not wake up in the middle of the night saying, I crave chocolate, like a lot of women do.
So I did email Arva back to say, I know how you feel, but we are talking today about the savory qualities, and you got quite excited about that.
Yes, because salted anything, so salt on chocolate redeems chocolate for me.
It redeems it.
Or for example, chili on chocolate. Like, one of my all-time favorite desserts was actually something I had in Seattle, which was this dark chocolate block. It was called El Diablo at a Spanish restaurant, a dark chocolate block, which was over a burnt meringue with toasted almonds. And then I think it just had some crispy, spicy flakes of something I quite can't remember, but it was essentially salty, crunchy, creamy, and spicy, and that whole combination was so appealing. So chocolate on its own, like just a bar of chocolate, I find a little bit monotonous, but chocolate when it's paired with the right flavors, so, you know, when we were doing the chocolate tasting trail, a lot of it was actually pairing chocolate with different and interesting flavors, whether it was with lemongrass or rose or whatever, I find that to be more appealing.
Andre, I'm going to bring you into the conversation. Now, where do you stand on the scales of the use of chocolate in terms of savory and sweet?
I mean, I'll tell you, and this, I don't want to lose friends on this show, because but seriously,
no judgment.
This is a bit blasphemous, but the truth is, my favorite chocolate is white chocolate, and anybody who loves chocolate or is even remotely serious Well, guffaw at the idea that white chocolate is
not a chocolate. They don't consider it as chocolate. There's no cocoa mass in there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. There's nothing in it. It's basically what they put to fool adults into thinking it's chocolate.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with that. Now, I don't have any interesting experiences like El Diablo over here. but the truth is, I think it's a great application. I think, especially, look, I'm from New York City. I grew up with a great, great plethora of Mexican restaurants in New York City, and one of the big things in Mexican cuisine is mole, right?
Yeah.
And the application of using chocolate in a savory context to me is totally delicious. It's an earthy flavor. And if you've ever had, and I've had this, if you've ever had really, really homemade a la minute hot chocolate where it's literally ground up from cocoa nibs, made for you with hot water. It's actually, it's not sweet.
It's called Coco Lovato.
Right. Right. And
it's from Mexico. Yeah.
And the texture is gorgeous.
Well, I just call it hot chocolate. You guys have the fanciest names. I love it.
No, but it's a gorgeous thing. And I mean, I think that when you have a great ingredient, you're able to use it like that, I think. And yes. I think James will say the same thing. It's delicious.
Yeah.
And it's not what you thought it was originally. So to answer your question, I do like, I'm more of a sweet guy for sure, given my predilection towards the not chocolate of white chocolates. But, I think there's a lot you can do with it, and I'm excited to see what he does with it today.
So we're going to be talking a lot of different chocolate things. I want to go into a little bit more detail about chocolate nibs, cocoa nibs, and find out more about those, because I didn't know a lot about that. I also want to talk, when we come back, to Andre about an incident with a tray. Michelle Luxon in for Suzanne Radford. And today I am talking chocolate and savory with three foodie experts. Ava Ahmed is from the Food Trails Adventures, that are frying pan adventures. Andre Gershel is from Local Organic Fresh Homemade Concept, that is Baker and Spice. And we have head chef James McDonald. He is the person behind this conversation because he has Cocoa Kitchen in City Walk. So before the break, I mentioned the incident, Andre.
That's mine. Okay, so just to be clear to everyone who's listening, I have a great track record at bringing and bribing all the great support staff here at Dubai Eye with tons of stuff.
Did you use the word bribing there?
I mean, I just gently nudging towards better nutrition. You want to use it that way? I'm their nutritional facilitator, and I normally bring such good stuff. And today I was on the way, and we dropped a tray of perfect, amazing, beautiful cannelé.
So you say we dropped the tray.
It was a group effort. It's a group drop. It's
was
a group
it you,
drop.
Andre?
I was part of the dropping. The oven door was also part of it, and I said behind, as you normally do in kitchens, but I might have said it in my head and not out loud. And so what ended up happening is eight beautiful pieces that I wanted to say for you guys went literally. I think the whole thing happened in slow motion, actually.
Mm. Do you know that the news of this incident has gone across Dubai Eye?
Because
the newsroom wait with bated breath to what the Thursday brunch will have in terms of leftovers every week. And they heard this, and there's soft sobbing happening.
I wish. Listen, unfortunately, we do not use the 5-second rule of Baker and Spice, but good news is that James is here to save me with some delicious chocolate treats.
Yes, James has brought some amazing things that he did not drop along. We're going to be doing a lot of tasting today. But that kind of made me think, and I was discussing with producer Joe as well. Have you ever dropped anything? I remember there was a time when my mom probably spent a day making this amazing, it must have been a lemon meringue tart thing, I don't know. And we were going on a bumpy road to someone's house, and I put my foot in it. My entire foot went. I was young. She was so upset, and she was so sad because you arrived with a foot shape in. Has that ever happened to you before, Chef? Have you ever done something amazing? You brought it out the kitchen.
Ah! Actually, I'm just having flashbacks right now of it. When I was a very young chef, as a commis chef, my chef gave me the beef cheeks out of the hot oven, and I thought I was the big strong man. I'm like, yeah, I'll take these. And so they've been braising all day, very slowly turning them. You know. Basting them with the jus and stuff like that. Take them out of the oven. I turn around.
Oh, no.
I go around the corner. I slipped on the floor. And then literally I had all of that evening's beef cheeks on the floor, and my chef behind me whipping me with a towel and like just cursing me to the hill. And I felt so terrible. I didn't know what to do. I actually think I almost broke out and started crying. I was upset with myself.
It's tough to decide which is worse, the loss in food or the embarrassment from the loss in food, right?
Arva?
I do these things all the time, actually, so they're no longer an embarrassment. They're kind of part of the routine. I think it was about a year ago, had baked interestingly, a chocolate meringue for someone else. Ooh. So I usually bake chocolatey things, I'll give them away. So I had baked this, thick, sort of almost like a mix between a brownie fudge gooey chocolate meringue with just a slightly sort of a cracked top.
Please, in the cake tin.
Right. And all I had to do was sit in the car, take it to Mirdiv City Center. Everything was fine. I just had to hand it over to the couple who had just had a baby. Mm. And at that point, as we're handing it over,
oh no,
I just dropped it.
You had gotten it to the location?
I got it to the location. We're handing. It's in the handover process. We're all excited.
I think you were like,
and it fell upside down. So I'm like, I'm not going to open it. It's meant to be cracked, so it's okay.
Did you do the thing where you just froze? Because, if you stand still enough, they don't see you.
Right? No, it was there. Everyone saw it, but I was like, well, it was meant, like it's this. A meringue, it's meant to be cracked anyway, so it's okay.
I think Jo's story, she told me a little bit earlier, I think it might top.
Well, I think it's transporting, isn't it? It's the transportation of said goods. And it reminded me of a story that we've grown up with all our life. And I was actually inside my mum's tummy and she was pregnant with me. And my elder sister was 2 years old. And my mum and dad at that time lived in Berlin. And they were invited round to my dad's boss's for an event, an evening meal. And they had spent half his weekly wages on this beautiful cake from this beautiful patisserie in Berlin, and it was absolutely stunning, and it was in this box, and my sister got into the car and sat on it.
Oh my god.
That's and textbook. We have grown up with that.
Oh my gosh. that must be still a family.
It must have gone into my bloodstream.
Oh, I love that.
Every Christmas time that one comes out.
The cake in Berlin. Yeah.
But I just thought it was a lovely question to ask the listeners. Has that ever happened to you? Has there ever been the incident that, is brought up every Christmas and person is, embarrassed by that? But it just happening this morning, it just made us giggle in the newsroom. So, Chef, I want to now talk about these cocoa nibs. So you mentioned how much you use them. And when I came to visit your restaurant a little while back, I think you used the word cocoa nibs in every second sentence. Tell us about them.
Well, that's the whole thing about the concept. We take the cocoa nib and we treat it like a spice. So I ask my customers when they come to the restaurant, all right, you're coming to a cacao restaurant. It's not a chocolate restaurant. We're a cacao restaurant. So when they come, they walk in, they sit, they look around, they see all the decor, and then we start talking about the cocoa nibs to them. And the cocoa nibs is the main part. So obviously, it's the raw product of chocolate, and we start with this. So we grind it down and make our marinades with it. But it's a great product. As a product, it's got those earthy textures you're talking about. You can relate to, mushrooms to it. It's got a bitterness to it, and it depends on where you get them as well. It depends on the origin of the cocoa as well. We'll talk about that later with our chocolate tasting, but obviously with different origins and different places where the cocoa comes from, it actually makes a big effect on the food. And so this is why we think about it as a spice and not as chocolate itself. And like you say, it is such a big player within the food I do, because chocolate is manipulated. Obviously you've added sugar, you've added soy lecithin to emulsify it, and then you've added cocoa butter, when we're using high quality chocolate. But as a raw product, the cocoa nib, and that's where it stands out. So this is where we can really deal with it. We can make pesto with no nuts and add the cocoa nibs to it.
Oh, that's interesting.
This is what I mean. We can add it to our rundown curry, which is a Caribbean curry, to it, and it gives an earthy flavor to it. We can put it to the chicken. When we grill chicken and these toast up, it gives an extra bite to the chicken as well. So it's just not a flavor, it's a texture as well that we use within the restaurant.
Arva, did you come across this when you were going off to do this chocolate trail? Did you find that people were, know as much about the cocoa nibs and know about its earthy flavor as much?
I think what's resonating with me is that I think historically that's probably closer to how chocolate was used. I think the way that we consume chocolate in its sweet form as bars or whatever else, I think that's actually pretty, if new age is the right word to say, it's a very modern, actually, in the world of food history. Traditionally, chocolate was used in this raw, unprocessed form. It was added into stews, and it was used more in its medicinal form. So people had this reaction that, oh, wow, it's bitter, it's medicinal. So in that sense, it resonates. It's almost as if you're kind of going back to basics. And I love this idea of using it as a spice, but not just as a spice, also in terms of its medicinal qualities, which is honestly hard to realize when you're, you know, stuffing your face with a Snickers bar, like it doesn't really feel medicinal. But in this form, which of course none of us ever do.
No.
Well, I mean, but I just, can you educate me just for a second? Because actually,
sure.
even though I work in the business, the nib is the inside of the pod itself. Like what part is the nib actually?
So obviously you got the outer shell of the cocoa bean itself, and that is harvest. Okay, so it takes about 3 years to get a harvest off a tree.
Whoa.
3 to 5 years to get a harvest off a tree.
Well, that's why good chocolate's expensive,
yeah.
I guess.
Exactly.
Right?
That's like coffee as well.
Yeah, and then from there, so you would open it up, and then inside the actual cocoa bean is a row of pearls. It's the most beautiful. It's literally like a row of pearls. And so each chocolate bean is covered in a white sap, like a white flesh. And this is what they call cocoa pulp. And this has a flavor of like a very light lychee. Not many people export this out. Brazil exported out. And as a flavor, this is amazing. I mean, like, if we could get more of this as well, this would be a great, great product. But talking about the cocoa nib itself, so they fermentate. So they fermentate the flesh off the outside for 7 days. And then what you're left with is the bean itself. And then the bean is dried and then roasted and then cracked. And then you have cocoa nib.
It's pretty similar to coffee, actually, right?
Yeah, it's like very
close. The coffee fruit, you dry it out. The flesh of the fruit comes off, and then within that is the nib itself.
Well, it's grown in the same areas.
Right.
Whenever you go to a cocoa plantation, you'll see coffee and papaya right next to each other.
That's
and stuff
a combination
like that.
I love. Espresso and chocolate. That's a great combination.
I'm going to ask Chef a little bit later, because he's been to these plantations before, and ask him what's it like there. But first, the news headlines are upon us, but before we get there, I need to fit in one of these.
Guess the ingredient.
So we have a fabulous 500 dirham voucher to go enjoy at Coco Kitchen. Andre and Ava are both the keeper of the clues today, but we're starting with number one. Andre has it.
Today's mystery ingredient is a dynamic red concoction and was first discovered by the British in Southeast Asia, who tried to replicate the flavor of the fermented dark sauce. The earliest known recipe published in 1732 for the mystery ingredient was written by Richard Bradley and referenced Ben Kulan in the East Indies as its origin.
Michelle Loxton in for Suzanne Radford. Three foodie experts I have around my Dubai Today studio table. Ava Ahmed, she is the woman behind the fantastical trails that are Frying Pan Adventures. Andre Gershel is in charge of the local, organic, fresh, homemade food concept that is Baker and Spice. And Coco Kitchen's head chef, James MacDonald, is proudly trying to put cocoa in every single one of his dishes. Now, Joe, we have a text in because a little bit earlier we spoke about how Andre was bringing us some delights.
Oh, gosh.
But unfortunately, the tray landed up on the floor. We don't really know who the culprit was. I suppose it's going to go to trial to find out whose fault it really was.
Gravity. I blame gravity.
Okay, we'll blame gravity. But I've been asking people at home, have we had any disasters? And Joe, we've had something from Jane.
And I was going to keep her anonymous, Michelle.
Oh, goodness. Sorry, Jane.
That's okay. We won't reveal her surname. There must be a few Janes out there. I had friends arriving for dinner. I'd been cooking all day. And moments before they arrived, I took the slow roasted leg of lamb out of the oven and the tray slipped and the leg of lamb fell onto the floor.
Oh, no.
And yes, the 5 second rule did count.
Good on you, Jane.
I did put it back into the tray and serve up. It was delicious and my floor spotless.
Okay, so now I know why you wanted to leave the name out of it. So 5 second rule. I'm going to start with Ava because I feel like she's going to be more honest with me. Second rule.
Whether I do it or not.
Has it ever happened?
All the time.
Yeah,
I can't. I mean, I don't believe in food wastage. Well, it depends on how spotless your floor is. If your floor is, you know, nasty, then obviously not. But otherwise, and it also depends on what you're looking at. If it's something that, like, for example, you can peel off. I am the queen of peeling off top layers, bottom layers, like refashioning an item and serving it. So it's
fine.
So
you do this often then? Yeah.
You just have to learn to work with the product.
What
that
do you mean
have.
By layers? Do you mean like you have a cheese in the fridge that's got a moldy edge and you kind of cut that off?
Well, with some cheeses, actually, that's okay. Not with all cheeses.
Okay.
It really depends what cheese you're looking at. But I mean, if you're going to drop something, this is at home, obviously. If I'm going to drop something, and not to a guest necessarily, but if I'm just having it, it for a meal myself, then I might just slice off the layer that's touched the floor. Okay. So that's an easy
way. I know Andre and Chef James are going to be like, absolutely not.
He and I are looking at each other.
If you're in a restaurant world, but I think if you talk to people who are cooking at home, I think our bar kind of drops. If I were serving other people, I think that it just changes.
I don't want to speak for Chef over here, but I personally can't wait to come to your house for dinner. I'm super excited.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit of food news now, because everybody's got a story. And I've got one that always makes me giggle, these kinds of stories.
Food news.
So here's the story. A US website calls mince on toast a British classic, and then New Zealand claims it. Okay, so New Zealand has claimed, and this is an article from The Guardian, and they've got quite spicy with their language here. So the article reads as thus. New Zealand has claimed the abomination and monstrosity that is mince on toast after American food website sparked uproar in the UK community when it claimed the dish was a classic British cuisine. So basically some person... They put this on an Instagram post and they said, oh, have a look at this lovely British classic, which is mince on toast. And the UK were like, no, absolutely not. And New Zealand said, it's ours. So I think we often have problems with these origins. You'll look into this sorts of thing, Ava.
Absolutely. I mean, I think food gets political and personal, and people get really territorial about food all the time, which I think is quite funny, because if you rewind back centuries and centuries and centuries ago, people who had two similar ingredients would probably have figured out to put them together, you know, which is not to take away pizza from the Italians. But essentially, I mean, for example, in India, we pair paratha with keema, which is mincemeat and bread, all the time. Yes, we don't layer it one on top of the other, but we scoop one with the other and have it. So I find these arguments, with especially when it's two very basic ingredients that intuitively you would throw together, I kind of find those...
Every culture has it.
Yeah.
Every single culture has that.
Even discussion. Turkish cuisine, right? Lahmacun is
exactly,
a perfect example of
exactly.
That.
So that's a good one, yeah.
So that's my news story today. Andre, I know you've brought one for us as well.
Yeah, I mean, this one's actually a bit personal for me. So I grew up in New York City, and it's always home for me. And I always grew up with the idea of a 24-hour diner. And that is just the classic American institution. And it's about lamenting the death of the American diner. And it's an article that came out in New York Magazine about how these types of restaurants, because of rising food costs, because of changing consumer habits, they're kind of dying out. And I think it's really sad because you can think of the aluminum booths, the neon lights, the kind of kitschiness.
The bottomless whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's dying out. And I think actually, you know, it's funny to see how many chefs on the high end still reach into things like that. Like when you know, Michelin star chefs want to do a grilled cheese, that's an interesting article for me. I want to read about how they're taking something like that.
Or a Michelin star chef that does fish and chips.
Totally. Because the truth is...
And they sort of stack the fries in a very, you know, elegant way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because the truth is, we all come home at the end of the night after, you know, a 14-hour shift, and what we want is bread and meat.
Yep.
Or bread and cheese, because it's the only thing that we really want to make for ourselves. And I think the diner has been the last bastion for that style food. And it's democratic. Everybody can come in. There's the, you know, the surly waiter or waitress that knows you and says, have a seat, hun. There's a culture. Yeah. There's such a strong culture there.
And how many movies has it been in? And actually, this is a tourism
Totally.
Pull.
Totally. Especially in New York City.
Yeah, but this is one of the reasons, you know, when I went on a tour of the States, I wanted to go to all the diners because that's what I'd seen in the movies.
Right, but even Route 66 is a concept, and stopping along as you do at, you know, a trip through the U.S. But I think it's really sad. It used to be, I mean, there's this, I mean, and I'll just read one line. The city's Department of Health lists around 400 restaurants with the words diner and coffee in their name, a number that experts say is down from 1,000 restaurants a generation ago. And that's sad, because these are family institutions, they're family businesses, they're small businesses, they're businesses that deserve spotlight and work tirelessly, and that people often grow up in. And I think that is... It's kind of a sad note, but if anyone wants to get out there and save the diner with me, if anyone's listening, I'm into it. We will not do a 5-second
grilled cheese with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
As long as I get grilled cheese, I'm backing you. Yeah, anything with cheese, I'm all over it.
100%. So I think that's definitely, and I think that also ties into cocoa and to chocolate and to all the things that we do, is that we're all constantly seeking to share the comfort food that we grew up with people that haven't had it before. And whether it's mince on toast, or whether it's paratha, or whether it's a great cup of hot chocolate, or whether that's that's why we do food businesses. So I think that's just very near and dear to me from a news perspective.
I think a lot of these, whatever, you know, we're talking about the diner today, but a lot of food concepts are sort of dying out. And I looked at this article a little bit earlier as we linked to cocoa. So cocoa prices are in decline by 30 to 40%.
Wow.
They had a bumper crop last year, apparently. But because of low global demand, because so many people are now going gluten-free, dairy-free, anything bad free, we're seeing this happen. And I suppose, are we evolving away to more of a vegetarian way? I don't know. It's evolving. It's changing. Are you seeing it out there, Ava?
Yeah, I mean, I think the increased emphasis on health is a good thing. I think the heightened paranoia is not necessarily something I agree with, because especially with all of this information out there, there's so much conflicting information and people are recycling sometimes incorrect information and you really get swept away. So you never really know what to believe. And I find that a little bit scary, and that essentially ends up influencing trends. So one day chocolate is the best thing that you could have for your body, yes, and then tomorrow it's the worst thing that you can have for your body. And you know, really done seeing people go through these cycles. What I've also seen is that deprivation always leads to an obsession. So the two kinds of things that you see trending on Instagram are going to be your avocado on toast or whatever sort of gluten-free dish, and then it'll be the slow melting ball of, you know, the chocolate globe which kind of melts as you pour something over it, or Nutella over Nutella over Nutella. So it's only those two extremes that are trending, and I sort of have this feeling that it might actually be the same group of people that are actually liking both ends of the spectrum.
Now, something that Chef was talking about a little bit earlier was about when describing the cocoa nib, and that kind of links a little bit and how beautiful it is. You know, you've gone and seen these cocoa nibs and you've been to a cocoa plantation before. That kind of links into the news story, because you mentioned earlier it's a little bit like coffee. We mentioned this, you know, the cultivation, and it kind of links into your news story today.
Well, exactly. I'd like to touch on like trending things about like food and what's healthy and what's not to eat these days. And my one's coffee. I don't have the luxury of reading a paper every day. I work a very busy, busy lifestyle. You know, I work maybe 6 to 7 days a week. I work 14 hours a day, you know. So, but what I hear is on the radio, what is trending at the moment is, it is good to drink coffee now. 3 cups a day will make you live longer. And I'm thinking in my head as I'm driving my car down the road, thinking, oh my gosh, chefs are going to live forever. We're the most miserable people in the world and we're going to live forever. Because I don't know about you guys, but I down a good 6 to 8 cups a day.
That's a Monday.
Is it more is better? Did the article specifically say more? Like, so
well,
3 versus 30?
Specify on this. They were just like, you know, up to 3 cups a day. And I'm just thinking, hey, I'm going super. Like, I'm just going to love it.
But then
I think a couple of years ago, you know, I went to my doctor and he was like, you need to cut out your coffee intake. And I was like, how come? He's like, oh, high blood pressure, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, cool. But now with this new study, it's amazing.
You just need to take that study to your doctor and be like, well.
I know. Yeah.
Well,
the question is, who funded that study?
If your doctor's listening right now, you should fire him immediately.
I did. I left the country.
But on a more serious note, Ava, that's actually right. Because often when you see, you know, a new study is out that says that this chocolate is very good for you. The study by ... company, which is a chocolate company. Exactly. So this is the problem behind it. Ava, your new story for today.
Sure. So, you know, as we're talking about declining food trends, one of the things that I came across, which really shocked me, was that, you know, the small petite boulangeries, the small little artisanal bakeries in France have actually been decreasing over the years.
No.
I mean, that I can understand in any other part of the world. In France?
But when I went to France, everybody's holding a baguette.
Exactly. But it seems like they're holding fewer baguettes or baguettes from
supermarkets
which to me is, just disclaimer, I've never been to France, but, you know, you kind of always hold that as your bread standard, if unless you have Baker and Spice, and then obviously Baker and Spice.
Oh, Arva, I'm blushing in the studio.
Right. And so there's essentially this baker who began in France. He was originally French, and then he went to the US. He opened up this entire, you know, a number of these small bakeries. They eventually shut down, I guess, because of dwindling purchases. He came back to France and he decided that he is going to pick up and buy each of these small little places and revive them together. So, for example, you know, through economies of purchasing, all of them are going to buy things together, or by just tightening up the business model and helping them with the economics. But it seems like, wow, you know, we've come to that time of the world where someone's having to revive bakeries in France. Something about that seems so wrong.
It does. And if you think about culture, how many, you know, sort of beautiful pictures have you seen drawn of a French woman walking down the street holding a baguette? You know, there has to be like a government institution that needs to come forward. Yeah, maybe they can work with the diners.
No, I mean, I'm serious, but I think that, you know, the greasy spoon is a universal idea. And I think if people get back in the kitchen, and this is, I mean, I think that if you make your own bread once, you fall in love with bread forever. It's such
I think both your stories relate. You know, sorry, I sit back. I love your story about the bread, and I love your story about the diner. But, you know, they're institutions that are dying. You know, bread, diners, butchers, fruit and veg markets.
Completely.
You know, everything's dying out now. You know, if you have a passion for food, you have to go to a massive supermarket and look in the back end, right in the bottom corner, for something that your grandma used to make.
Well, the way we cook has totally changed as well. And I think that's such a good point. And I think that we have to fall in love with the process of making food again, to fall in love with the institutions that serve them well. And I think that's as cooks, we take it for granted, right? Because it's so easy for us. When you have a huge industrial kitchen, that's the biggest thing, by the way. My friends who don't cook, that's the one thing they always say. They're like, well, it's so easy for you because you have. And the truth is, you don't have to choose the most, you don't have to run the same style menus, but you do have to get out there and you do have to cook, because it'll make you appreciate the raw ingredients. It'll make you appreciate coffee and cocoa and bread and flour in a way that I think is unique and beautiful, and really will let you connect with that.
Guess the ingredient.
So we have that 500 dirham voucher to give away to go to Coco Kitchen, and Ava has clue number two.
Today's mystery ingredient comes from a Hokkien Chinese word, which is the name of a sauce derived from fermented fish. It is believed that traders brought fish sauce from Vietnam to southeastern China. Most early British recipes of the mystery ingredient added mushrooms, walnuts, oysters, or anchovies in an effort to reproduce the savory taste first encountered in Asia. And Jane Austen's favorite was the mushroom variety.
Guess the ingredient.
So we have that 500 dirham voucher to give away today to go to the Coco Kitchen. Andre is the keeper of the clues right now. Clue number three.
The early versions of today's mystery ingredient were mostly thin and dark, and were often added to soups, sauces, meat, and fish. In 1812, scientist and horticulturalist James Mees added the key ingredients to the recipe, referred to as love apples. His recipe contained its pulp and spices, but lacked vinegar and sugar.
Gosh, there's lots of crazy things in this mystery ingredient today. Let's carry on with a little bit of food news. Andre, you have been overachieving today, and you've brought us two food news stories today.
After my tray drop, yes. I mean, I got to make up for it now. The other thing I wanted to talk about was actually olive oil. And I guess it's more of a discussion about provenance and what you should be paying for that, and why things are expensive. And we talk about cocoa and we talk about coffee. But the interesting thing is, I think a lot of people, when it comes to olive oil, probably spend more than they need to, when they could be buying better for less. And there was an article recently in Forbes that talks about how extra virgin olive oil, and sometimes the demarcations on those labels, are often false. And they do a test on how much olive oil per ml, per bottle, is actually in there versus water content versus added.
So they're actually lying to us.
To a certain extent, yes, right? Or they're misleading customers intentionally to convince them that it's first press or cold press, when in fact it's not. And I'll share with you, this was the line that really got me. Real extra virgin olive oil is the world's healthiest and most widely used fat, and a rarity among foods. Was approved by the FDA to bear the specific health claims on its labels, an arduous process akin to certifying a new drug. And that is such an interesting idea to me, that we're going to start putting a microscope on specific base level ingredients. And I hope that to a certain extent that becomes a global trend, because what ends up happening is that farmers become more accountable, but you connect the consumer to the farmer and the producer in a way that's really nice.
I suppose it's a whole the organic argument. When you look at something and the bottle, it says that it's organic, and you hope that you're being told the truth when you're going into the supermarket, because they keep telling us how good organic is, so you go and fork out more money to pay for it. It's awful if they're not
completely. And I've spoken about this on the show many times before, and I think Arva and I have had 100 conversations. Organic shouldn't inherently be more expensive. Okay. It means that you're using less things to produce the same amount. Yeah. Now, I understand the yield is lower, but if everybody starts buying organic, it actually becomes significantly cheaper than what we're buying at now.
Mm. Now, a beautiful smell has filled the studio.
Totally.
Because Chef has been busy. Chef, tell us what you've been up to.
So last night I was quite busy, I'm not going to lie. So today I brought in some cocoa pasta tortellinis that are stuffed with butternut squash, bulgur wheat, and ricotta cheese.
Oh, gorgeous.
That's to start with anyway.
Okay, so tell us about how you came up with that. Because when I hear something like that, I think, oh, I've never heard of this before. Are you like a magician in the kitchen where you just kind of bring all these things together, and how am I going to bring the cocoa nibs in? How does it work for you when you're creating things to go on your menu?
Well, I have a simple rule when I cook. You know, I'm not reinventing the wheel. I'm just using my culinary experiences to put flavors together. So when you would roast a butternut squash, you know, at the end, you'd add a little bit of nutmeg. Yeah,
yes.
It gives a nutty flavor there. Mm. Yeah, a little bit of brown butter, a little bit of rosemary. Cocoa has those.
Right.
As a raw product, cocoa nibs have those characteristics. So it was just a natural progression that way. So this is how we're going to do it. And then I'm thinking, how am I going to put this together? And everyone's had spinach pasta before. Yeah.
No, of course. Especially in tortellini as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was just like, well, when you make the pasta green, you know, I was thinking, well, why don't I just put the cocoa powder in there?
Right.
So the cocoa powder is actually in the pasta.
Ingenious.
And it's got this rich kind of, it's almost aubergine color, right? It's got this kind of between brown and this gorgeous purple. You can smell right away the ricotta, even the nibs. And just opening this, you get this great kind of earthy flavor here.
Mm.
And it's deep and chocolatey, but not in a sweet way, in a really nice savory way.
So I'm going to ask Andre and Arva to do a little tasting. And whilst that's happening, I want to ask something that we mentioned a little earlier, Chef, was origin. So let's talk about origin, and you'll tell us a bit about where you got your cocoa nibs from. We talk about how important it is, but where do you get yours from?
Okay, so first off, to start with, chocolate only grows 17 degrees above each side of the equator.
Hmm.
So it has to be in a tropical area. So all these things where you read on the back of the bag will touch on your olive oil, where they lie to you saying,
right,
made or grown in France, it's impossible. It's impossible. You cannot grow chocolate in Belgium, Sweden, Switzerland, and France. Okay, so that's the first
Italian
one.
Coffee, another thing.
That's, yeah, that's, right? Italian coffee is another thing, because obviously the coffee plant grows next door to the cocoa plant. So where I get my chocolate, so we're going to do a little tasting later on it. I have some milk chocolate, which is Papua New Guinean, and that is the 35%. I have a Peruvian chocolate, which is quite fruity, 65%. Sorry, I'm just looking over at my chocolate bar because I've forgotten what I
have.
There's
a lot of them, have you?
And there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Tell us, Arva, we do need to go to the news headlines soon, but you have tasted that. Tell me.
I have. I scarfed it down. you know what? What was interesting is I think the chocolate aroma plays, like the actual aroma, the experience begins with the aroma of chocolate. Like that in itself was enticing. The minute Chef walked in, you smell chocolate, and then you're automatically primed for a dessert and not something savory. I actually really loved it. For someone who is not usually a chocolate fan in something sweet, the savory version is amazing. I mean, when you put it in your mouth, it plays on the back of your mouth. Andre, I don't know if you felt the same way, but it's very earthy, it's very warm, it's very toasty.
Mm.
And all of the herbs, and I don't know how much of that was actually sage and things that were going into the butternut squash, or whether that was the flavor of the chocolate, but it just felt like it worked, you know, as one united flavor rather than this chocolate standing out as a sore thumb.
Andre?
Yeah, the butternut squash is marrying the cocoa pasta base and the ricotta really nicely, right? So you have the creamy texture of ricotta, you have the sweetness of the butternut, and you have that slight, you know, starchy, earthy taste from the cocoa pasta shell. It's it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous dish.
Michelle Luxton in for Suzanne Radford while she's away. And this week I've brought three foodie experts around the table to talk chocolate and its savory qualities, and its sweet, of course. But we've been really, really interested in learning more about its savory qualities as well. I have Ava Ahmed. She's the chief executive muncher of Frying Pan Adventures. I also have Andre Groeschel, who is the director of operations at a restaurant that has a very simple concept. It's local, organic, fresh, homemade, and that is Baker and Spice. And last but certainly not least, the man that brought up this whole conversation. He is head chef James MacDonald. He is behind the concept that is Coco Kitchen at City Walk. And now we have, the time has come. We've been waiting, James, for this moment. You're going to take us through a cocoa tasting. What is the?
So we're going to start with some chocolate, and this is the best part of my job. I love this. I'm not going to lie. Yeah.
It's the best part of my job.
Literally, when they say, "Do you want to work in a chocolate shop?" I was like, "Oh, yes, please." So this is what we're going to start with. So we're going to start with some milk chocolate. So it's a 35% Papua New Guinean chocolate. Mm. Whenever I do a chocolate tasting with people, I always say, "Think of the country. You know, what colours do you think of? What kind of a journey is it going to take on?" Because chocolate takes you on a journey. So this is not cheap chocolate. So this is made with cocoa butter and cocoa mass in there as well, okay? So have a little taste. So this has all been tempered. It's got a nice little crisp to it. And
just so, when you temper chocolate, it means that you're heating it up and then cooling it down very carefully to remove impurities. Is that right?
No, it's not. It's actually just to change the crystals in the chocolate to give it that snap. So obviously this
snap.
Is snap. So it gives that crackle effect. So it gives that break. Obviously, when you use curvature chocolate, if you just melt it and set it, it'll bend.
Mm.
It'll be like rubber. So it'll bend and rubber. So when you do curvature chocolate, so when you're changing the crystals in there, so you're taking it to a certain temperature, lowering it, and then bringing it to a temperature which you can apply to whatever you want to make with
them. It's an amazing process to watch. They lay it out on a big sort of marble slab, yeah. And they're just sitting there mixing chocolate.
A lot of people love filming that.
Oh, it's great.
I mean, you watch on the internet, you know, you watch anywhere, someone tempering chocolate, it's like food porn.
This is absolutely beautiful. This is, and it's not too overwhelming. How did you choose that you were going to get Papua New Guinea milk chocolate?
Well, again, you know, a great part of my job, I line up 10 different types of milk chocolate from around the world and I get to eat it all. But yeah, that's what I do. I taste it. We have a panel, we go on a journey, we eat the chocolate and see what suits our palate. Cooking is very selfish, I find, and so is eating chocolate. You know, obviously this is a chocolate I like to use, and so I serve it in the restaurant I work in.
It's delicious.
And what kind of dishes would this go into?
So this one, obviously we use this more for our sweets we do. So we make mousses from that, and we make chocolate shells out of it, out of the cocoa pods. You people at home can't see this right now, but I'm holding a chocolate shell that we make, and it's you should drop on down to Coco Kitchen and have a little look at it, because they're amazing. That's what we usually use the milk chocolate for, but I'm trying to work on using it with fish.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
How?
Like oily fish. Not like your sea bass or breams or, you know, your light fish like that. I'm looking at some more oily fish in there and, you know, different tones. You know, touching on lemons, grapefruits in there as well. You know, you're changing, right. You know, okay. I'm not just using milk chocolate. It's going to be citrus in there, something bitter in there as well. Changing the dynamics of the whole flavor of the dish.
I'm just thinking now, because Ava got very excited about tasters. When you're experimenting with dishes, I'm sure Ava's going to be like, pick me. I'm available for the fish, lemon, citrus tasting. But who is subjected? I know that's not the word to use, but who is put in front of you to say, try this. I'm going to put this in the menu. I don't know about it yet.
Well, I actually start at home as well. I do a lot of experimental, you know. My wife's seen a few, like, flops, definitely, I've got to say. But, yeah, it all starts from home, and then I take it into the restaurant, and then we all try and sit around. But, you know, obviously I trust my team that I work with. Obviously, you know, working in a kitchen is about a team team playing thing. So we just sit around, have a couple of dishes. If it works out, then we take it to the next level, and then we evolve the dish. You know, obviously we start with a base flavor, and then we evolve it and see how creative we can get with it and finishing it with.
Okay, so that's the milk chocolate that we started with. We're going to move to our next one, which is...
So the next one is 70% from the Caribbean islands. So this is a lot more darker. So okay.
This is my kind of chocolate.
Yeah, this is significantly darker, and it has that earthy flavor.
So we Yeah, sorry.
No, go for it.
No, please, after you.
I was getting excited.
Yeah, no, because, so I'll be honest, I'm not a milk chocolate kind of person, but I love stuff like this because you can, right off the bat, you can taste the bitterness, but then when you sort of get through the chocolate, you can get that, you know, sort of like a bitter cherry almost, so it develops into that fruitiness. I love it.
The layers. That's what it is. It's not like your dad's dark chocolate at home when we were kids eating it. It was just bitter, dark, and disgusting. Yeah.
So I can actually remember. It's like black licorice.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the worst licorice ever.
So this is our stock. This is what I would use as my base chocolate. So I use this a lot. I use this for cooking in the sauces. I use it in the pastry as well. I'll use it with foie gras, you know, grated over foie gras as well. So this is a very good base dark chocolate. You know, it's a little bit complex, like you're saying. You start at the beginning. And you're like, oh, okay, so it's getting a little bit bitter. And then you say cherries, nuttiness in there. It evolves. And at the end, it's quite sweet on the back of your, on the back of your mouth.
The mouthfeel is great. So it really coats your mouth.
Yeah. And you get a lot of saliva with it as well. So it moistens your mouth.
It's a
so
natural you wanna, reaction.
It is. You know, instead of like touching back with dad's dark chocolate, your face was tight and it was dry and all you wanted to do was gag because it was really bad.
And how do you get this in? Is this chocolate that we've only tasted two so far, but is this readily available here in Dubai?
Yes, it is. When you look around, a lot of people are doing single origin chocolate now. I know of a few places, not off the top of my head, but in like Emirates Mall, I buy chocolate from there. I know in Dubai Mall, they have chocolate shops in there, but they're boutique chocolate shops. Mm. I'm going to say, you know, I do like my mass-produced chocolate. You know, give me a caramel Kit Kat any day, you know, but when I want to have...
When the craving happens.
When the craving happens. But yeah, this is the other end.
I have a question. In terms of caffeine content, that just felt like it should have a lot of caffeine, the dark chocolate that we just tasted, the 70%.
It's full of antioxidants, actually. Eating it is, like I say, it's cocoa mass. So what you're having here is 70% cocoa mass. So this is pure cocoa nibs ground down. And then the other 30% is the sugar and the cocoa butter that's just going in, which I like to add, it is cocoa butter and not palm oil.
Right.
What a lot of chocolate makers put in there.
Of course.
And that's the difference. That's where you get the layers of the flavor.
I wanted to ask you, Andre, so bringing you in now, you at Baker & Spes, the concept is local, organic, fresh, homemade. Where do you get your cocoa chocolate?
So one of the things that we've been working with actually is that we're trying to transition into always working with local companies. At the moment, we buy from Valrhona, and that's not local at all. That's a very old school, sort of tried and true chocolate supplier. And I would say, I mean, Chef, about what, 80 to 90% of commercial kitchens use Valrhona.
Yeah, it's either Valrhona or Calibo Barry.
We switched to Calibo, and the nice thing is that I've been working on transitioning to Mirzam, which is a local company that's actually bringing the nibs in and doing their own bars. The hard thing is that when you need commercial chocolate, the way that we do as a bakery, so we put them into our pain au chocolat, we put them into all of our cakes, cookies, what we need is a very specific cocoa content, but it also has to be a very stable product. And as Chef will tell you, chocolates, because the cocoa butter, it'll bloom if it's not kept at the exact right shelf life. And chocolate in the desert is a difficult affair, right? You have to keep it. It's super, super temperamental. So we do temper all of our own chocolate in-house. So I have an amazing pastry and bakery team. Chef Alia, Chef Madan, and Chef Manish, they're kind of leading the kitchen team all together. And they, you know, are always sort of working with trying to find more stable products. So I'm stuck somewhere between wanting to buy a Ferrari that's difficult to maintain and a Toyota that I know is going to do what it's supposed to do.
I wouldn't call Valrhona a Toyota.
No,
whoa,
it's
whoa,
not.
Whoa, whoa, settle down there, son.
Not,
yeah,
it's not. No,
I think you'll have a couple of pastry chefs at your door later.
No. Listen, it's a great product, but we've started to work with Mirzam, which is in Alkuz. It's this great local chocolate roasting factory. It's literally, and it's
amazing. You should go
there.
It's
totally
amazing.
We should
all go on a tour there. It sounds like chocolate roasting.
So I'm going to hopefully work with them. But I think that, you know, that's really the ethos. Again, chocolate doesn't grow here. If it did, I would buy it right away.
Number three, Chef. So we started with the milk chocolate. We went on to a 70% darker chocolate. Now we're on to number three.
And then we're going to stay with 70%, and now we're off to Cuba. Okay, so this is a 70%. So I wanted to bring in two 70s, and I want you to try. This is a lot darker. Think cigars.
Darker than the darker before.
They're darker than the darker than before, yeah. We're going into the darkness realm now. So this is smoky. You know, you think tannins, you think molasses, you think, you know, a lot stronger flavors. Mm.
Smoky is the perfect way to describe it, actually, yeah.
And what dishes are you using this in?
This is what I make my chocolate fondant out of.
Yeah. Wow.
And this is what packs the punch. It's dark, it's strong, but obviously for us to lighten it, we put white chocolate in the middle of our chocolate fondant. So you get that double layer of chocolate.
Finally. I was waiting this whole time.
Here it is.
There we go.
Chocolate's out there.
Do you ever get bored of chocolate? Is that like, am I saying something terrible to you?
No.
Are you ever overwhelmed by
No, not really. Because no. I love chocolate. I love cooking. I love food in general. I love all ingredients, actually. You know, it excites me seeing everything. But yeah, chocolate is something I can't get bored of, especially the way I'm going into chocolate. I love sweet chocolate. I love my dark chocolate. But then, you know, how many people get to cook with cocoa nibs? Do you know? Yeah. I don't know too many other people that are doing this. There's no book I can read to go, okay, I'm writing a new recipe. How am I going to put cocoa nibs in this or white chocolate in this or something?
But you'll have to write the book, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think
you sound like my wife.
Using nibs as a spice, it's like, do you get sick of salt? Do you get sick of black pepper? Do you get sick of cumin? You can't really, because the applications are so wide.
So now, Arvid, you enjoyed the last one, the darker one. Now the even darker one that we've got here, well, it's a more of a smoky flavors. What did you think of this one?
You know, I think I didn't put the word smoky on it, but when you said it, that immediately sort of hit. It just felt much more mellow and earthy than the last one, because the last one, the bitterness really hit you, which I loved. But it made me think when you said smoky, and you might be already doing this at the restaurant, but it'd be interesting to see a smoked application to sort of amplify that smokiness of the chocolate.
You talk about that. Actually, growers are starting to smoke their cocoa before they give it to the chocolate makers now. So as they're drying it on big wooden beds, they actually light fires and they smoke the cocoa.
Oh, fabulous.
And then they're making chocolate with that. That is a dream. A dream.
But couldn't you think of, for example, there are dishes that, you know, even at home, for example, we infuse smoke into certain rice dishes or into certain kinds of lamb dishes or even into yogurts where, you know, we just put ghee onto something, put the spice that we want, the smokiness of that spice to hit the dish, and then we seal it, you know, with a cloth. I wonder if that's something that would even work with the chocolate without it melting or getting ruined or whatever else. Who knows? It's just a thought that hit
my
mind.
It does actually, because actually on the blog which I gave you guys, I've given them a cocoa barbecue recipe. And
we're going to go through that a little bit.
Yeah, and I just want to touch on the smoke about that. So I've given you a recipe for this smoke element, and it's actually liquid hickory.
Oh, yes.
And so you can actually put a couple of drops of liquid hickory essence in there to make your chocolate barbecue sauce. Like that little smoking element. But yeah, definitely. I always think about different ways how to bring different textures and different smells. And like you were saying before about the chocolate, it's about the aroma. And then, you know,
absolutely.
When you get that hickory smoke hit your face, you're like, oh, wow. I'm in for it now.
Yeah. The dish has started.
We have one more tasting to do. We're going to be doing that next, but I do have to fit in one of these first.
Guess the ingredient.
So we have that 500 dirham voucher to go to Coco Kitchen. Who are we on to, Arva? Are we on to clue number four?
We are. The success of today's mystery ingredient was due to the fact that it could be kept for up to a year, but the preservation of the mystery ingredient proved a challenge. Some producers handled and stored the product so poorly that the mystery ingredient contained bacteria, spores, yeast, and mold, leading French cookbook author Pierre Bleau to call the commercial variety filthy, decomposed, and putrid in 1866.
We are right in the middle of a chocolate tasting with a chef, James MacDonald. He's from Coco Kitchen. So we started off with the milk chocolate. Then we moved on to 70%, I think, from Papua New Guinea. It was number two, I think.
No, we had 35% milk chocolate from Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And we had Cuba, 70%. That was the third one. And the second one was from the Caribbean Islands.
Okay, so number four.
Number four. So this is, I call, a training wheel chocolate. So this is for people that don't like dark chocolate, that have that whole stigma of, oh my God, it's bitter, it's disgusting. So this is actually a 65%. So it has a little bit more sugar in there. And this is a Peruvian chocolate, and it's very fruity. So you get a lot of fruit behind this chocolate. Like I say, the people that do give dark chocolate a bad name, I say, please have a little taste of this. And they're always quite surprised. because
starting them off on this one.
Mm. Yeah,
I like, by the way, the reference point, which was that the fruit of the actual cocoa nib is, it's similar to lychee, and I think that definitely does translate it into a subtleness. It, like, because lychee is a fruit, right? Doesn't have this overbearing. It's this kind of exotic, very subtle flavor, and I think that probably does actually translate frequently into the way chocolate is hits your palate for sure.
So tell me where you're using this one now.
This one, I actually had it on a chicken risotto at one stage.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
So tell us more about that.
I actually took this and I smoked it with hay, actually. I smoked it in a bed of hay and then I...
actual hay from...
guinea pig hay.
Okay.
Yeah, like what you give your rabbits. Yeah?
Okay, right.
So I smoked the chocolate first and then I put rosemary over the top of it and then I put some coarse sea salt over it, so it gives it that crunch of... And I served it with a chicken risotto.
Ava,
that's my kind of dish. What can I say?
So, hearing this, Andre, are you kind of getting ideas in your head? Are you going to go back to your chefs and be like, this is what I heard today?
I mean, we're a bakery. So, I mean, I would love to see more interesting ways for us to use. I mean, we are, you know, we're champions of the sweet side of the applications of chocolate. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've ever done anything with savory, but we did... a rosemary and dark chocolate, hot chocolate once, which was really nice. And we had crystallized the rosemary in saffron sugar syrup and then laid it on. So we do stuff like that. But it is interesting to use chocolate in a savory application. It's not something we've done before.
You know, what that sparks up for me, though, is that Middle Eastern twist, which you guys do so well on everything. And Chef, I'd be interested whether you have a savory or even, I guess, a sweet, maybe more of a savory dish where you play off chocolate with something that's kind of traditional to the region. Because one of the things that I made at home recently based on a David Leibovitz recipe, and this was a sweet application, but I'm sure there would be a savory application, is chocolate tahine cookies. And chocolate and tahine, I've had it multiple times,
great,
even in savory.
Great combination.
It is such a fabulous
sesame seeds,
combination.
Chocolate.
It just works, you know. So I'd be interested in whether you have any sort of play on that.
Well, not so much on the savory side, but on our sweet side, we are like looking at local spices to go with it. Obviously, we look at saffron, rose waters and things like that. But obviously, we do have hummus. You know,
the chocolate hummus.
Well, no, it's not that far. Well. So we actually take our hummus. So it's made to a local recipe. So obviously I had to change it from my European recipe. So it's made.
That
to
was
a
interesting when you told me about that, because you had it originally in your European, and people were like,
Yeah. Well, obviously in Europe we're very fond of olive oils and roasted garlic, things like this. But here it's a little bit more tahina based and lemon based, very sour.
Even yogurt, right?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
The fats.
This is exactly what we're looking at. So obviously I had to adapt a lot of my recipes moving to this country. And obviously just listening to people, you know, people eating my restaurant and then changing it. But getting back to, do I have anything local? So yeah, I do have a hummus recipe and we do almonds on top with cocoa butter.
Nice.
So that is a little aspect there, but not so much chocolate. It's just another aspect of a cacao that we use.
Now, obviously, when we talk about chocolate, we often think of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And the reason I wanted to bring this up, because I've been to Chef James's restaurant. You told me design there, and there are a number of things to a chocolate factory. Pipes.
Yeah, sure. So the pipes on the ceiling. So I'm quite fortunate. I've actually worked for a chocolate factory, and I've actually been in a real chocolate factory. And let me just say, the aroma of it, it's amazing. It gets on your skin, it gets in your hair, it gets in your beard, and everyone loves
it
you.
It doesn't leave.
You're bottling it up and selling that.
Pretty much, yes.
You got to backpack your clothing.
Yeah.
Odor the cocoa, yeah. But anyway, so so above our ceiling of my restaurant are copper piping that run through it. And it mimics exactly the same way as you would see in a chocolate factory. You would have liquid chocolate running over your head at all times, running over everywhere. And so these pipes just go in and out, in and out, in and out. So they come in from our kitchen and out from our kitchen as well. And then when you would look up upon the wall, you would see all these antique chocolate molds.
Yeah, so it I noticed them, of course, because it's beautiful design. So these olden molds. But when you told me the story behind them and the fact that they're not just fake molds that somebody kind of, you know, put them together because you wanted this design. They actually are real molds that you've been had have been used before.
They're all antique molds. So obviously these days they make chocolate with plastic molds, but these are all old metal molds, like aluminium and tin and stuff like that.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
And it is, they're actually, they were researched and found, and every mold has a story. And you look up there, and it celebrates a different time of the year. And that's a great thing about chocolate. It marries this thing of, you know, family, friendship, you know, times of the year, a wall of homage there.
That's wonderful.
And there was some, I didn't realize all these different molds that they were using. It was, I think there was even a fish.
Yeah, sturgeon.
Like a fish style chocolate, or obviously the Easter egg.
Sturgeon, was that
sturgeon.
What it was?
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so all these different ones. So there's the pipes. There's also the molds on the wall. Let's talk about the container.
Oh, so the container ship, yeah, the famous container ship. Yes. So, again, touching, we didn't get a fake container ship door. We got a real container ship door.
How did you manage that?
Oh, man, I watched 21 people carry that thing in, and it was like watching the pyramids being made with little rolls of wood pushing it along the floor. It was pretty full on. So the container ship represents a day of when packaging. So obviously when you would package chocolate, you'd sit in a big line, and then the people would sit there, wrap the chocolate, put it into a box, slide it to the end of the table, and then someone would literally just pack it straight into the container ship. And then the container ship would get locked up, and then off it goes, and another container ship would come.
Wow.
And that's the original packaging of chocolate, well, modern packaging of chocolate that we have. And the story goes that container ship there, the key has been lost, and inside is full of chocolate.
Oh, come on now.
And is there like a treasure map, Chef?
Well, we're working on that.
There's not a treasure map, but there's going to be me with a ski mask and a sledgehammer breaking into City Walk tonight. That's what's going
to
happen.
The final thing I wanted to ask you about, another thing that you have in there, which is quite lovely and really interesting, is the lights. So the lights are sort of hanging from these sort of pulleys.
Yeah.
And you said there's a reason for that, and these pulleys were really useful back in the day in chocolate factories.
Okay, yeah. So the lights are really cool. So the whole point of the pulleys is... rats love chocolate. Rats and mice love chocolate.
Just like us, they love
chocolate. Yeah, yes. And they have a big problem. So back in the day, before extermination and, you know, doors that have proper seals on them and that, so what they used to do was they'd take the cocoa and they would hoist it up on pulleys. Rats don't jump and they don't climb down. Like on Pirates of the Caribbean, when you see the rats run up the lines, yes, they run up the lines, but they don't run vertically.
Oh,
interesting. So they lift the cocoa off the ground so they wouldn't get eaten.
I need to go watch Pirates of the Caribbean again. Now I'm going to do the whole fact checking.
Just with a focus on the rats.
Authentic pirate rats.
Guess the ingredient.
So we have a 500 dirham voucher to go to that restaurant that we've been talking about now. That's Coco Kitchen. We have, who's the keeper of the clues? Andre, number 5?
I am indeed. Today's mystery ingredient is low in fat. It has 15 calories per tablespoon and contains vitamins A and C, which are key for a healthy immune system and good vision. However, it is also packed with sugar and salt, so it's possibly not the best thing for a serious health kick.
Michelle Loxton in for Suzanne Radford while she's away. And today I have recruited 3 foodie experts. They are Ava Ahmed. She's the food trail woman behind the Frying Pan Adventures. Andre Gershel is from Local Organic Fresh, homemade concept that is baker and spice. And we have head chef James McDonald. He's from Coco Kitchen, and he started off this conversation today. And he's been feeding us more and more. Chef, what have you got now?
More, she says, more. Okay, so...
give it to me, yeah.
Well, we have white chocolate mashed potato here. And we have a fillet of steak.
So, slow down, Chef.
Sorry.
Did you say white chocolate mashed potato?
Yes, white chocolate mashed potato.
And you've given us this recipe.
Yes, I have.
You've been very generous.
I think this is a good starter for some people.
Okay.
You know, to start their chocolate journey. You know, obviously, white chocolate, mashed potato, what's there not to like?
Okay. And with the white chocolate, sorry, I interrupted you there.
That's okay. With the white chocolate, so we have a fillet of beef, tenderloin, and that is crusted in cocoa nibs on the outside. And then to serve with that, we have a beef chocolate jus.
So, Andre, Ava, have you tasted it?
Yeah, I never thought I would like this mashed potato white chocolate. It's actually gorgeous. It's got great texture.
What is it?
It's buttery.
Okay.
And it has that like buttery, nice finish. And the sweetness isn't over the top. It matches really nicely with the starch. And I think actually if you wanted to do almost like a dairy-free, if you didn't want to put cow dairy into mashed potatoes to mix in this white chocolate, I'm not missing anything. It's not overly sweet. There's not a sugary taste from it.
It's so soft and buttery.
And super buttery. It's super buttery.
It's almost hard to put your finger on it. It's like you've done something magic with the butter, but it's actually the chocolate, right? Oh, Ava, help me.
I'm just going to say that I will fight anyone to take those leftovers home.
Oh,
100%.
The Erin News Center already waiting at the door.
100%. I was really hoping that Andre wouldn't like it, and now everyone's got their eyes on it.
Even the jus, by the way, as well.
And exactly.
Let's talk about the jus and the tenderloin. So you've talked about mashed potato. Everybody loves it. So, Chef, tell us a little bit about making that.
Okay, so the jus. So classically French, it is. So we make a stock with veal bones and veal trotters as well. And we roast those off, and then we cook our stock for 24 hours from there to get all the gelatin out of there. And then from there, we reduce it down, and then we caramelize our onions with our beef. And then we make like a braise of the trimmings. And then we cook that only for 3 hours to keep the freshness of the meat there. Because if you overbraise, you get not such a beefy, you know, not the beefy effect you want. It's a low-grade flavor because you cook the scent, the aroma out of the beef then. And then from there, we emulsify a little bit of butter and our chocolate into it.
Do you think, Ava, Andre, if we hadn't told, I'm just thinking now, if we hadn't known that there was cocoa nibs or chocolate behind this, would you have picked it
to be honest
up?
I wouldn't have guessed. For me, this is like the perfectly composed, you know, slow braised. It's like all that stuff at the base of the pan, which I love, and it's just been perfectly deglazed, and it's, you know, that slight bitterness and the beefiness. I mean, it's got like all the best components of beef just boiled down into one. So, and I don't think it's a bad thing that I can't taste the chocolate separately. I mean, I don't know if it's the bitterness of the chocolate that, if any, which kind of chocolate was used actually in this
one? So in the sauce, it's actually the 70%, which you like, from the Caribbean.
Okay,
that's it. Yeah, it's more of a rounding flavor of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can taste it in the jus for sure.
Yeah.
That, it's super pronounced. And I think if you had it also, if you can just give us about 150 more pieces, I definitely think I would eventually get to that cocoa flavor. But I think even the crust on the outside of the protein of the beef, you can kind of pick up on it. And it's a spice, right? The problem is we eat this and we're looking for that sugary taste, but it's not there because it shouldn't be.
That's something I really wanted to, you know, say to our listeners, is that it's not like taking a Mars bar and melting it on a
right,
steak.
No.
This is not what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
And I almost, if you hadn't told me, if you blindfolded me, I would have been like, how did you make those mashed potatoes? There's something about them.
Well, I'd like to touch on, like, we've all seen the movie Le Chocolat.
Yes, of course.
Famous scene where they're out in the garden, they're having lamb chops, and they have a big pot of dark chocolate, and they're dipping lamb chops in pure chocolate. Try it. It's not as good as you think, okay? I thought, like, yeah, I'm going to try that, and I did, and it's not as good as you think. You're like, well, that really needs a lot of work.
It's just really good acting,
but that's
perhaps.
That's the problem, you know. When people do think about chocolate, they think of that, you know, right. They think I'm taking a Snickers bar, putting it in a quail and roasting it and giving it to them.
Yeah. Let's talk about the cocoa nibs, because you use the cocoa nibs in there.
Sure.
And we wanted to taste a little. Have we got some of the cocoa nibs?
Because
we've mentioned it throughout the show, but you wanted to talk more about these flavors.
So cocoa nibs. So obviously, these aren't a single origin cocoa nib straight away. So this is a mass-produced cocoa nib straight up. It has a little bit of a sour effect to it, I find. Excuse me.
And it has a crunchiness too, by the way, immediately when you have a bite.
It's definitely textured. It's like maybe biting a coffee bean. It has that crunch, but it's a little bit softer to it. And the flavors, it's an explosion in your mouth of, first thing, it is bitterness. You get a lot of bitterness with it, but then you follow through with that cocoa flavor. And depending on where the chocolate nib comes from, and it depends on the characteristic of the nib.
For me, I think also when you're just chewing on the actual nib itself, you do get that bitterness in the beginning, but the aftertaste, it reminds me of an amazing rich hot chocolate, and I think that sort of textural mouthfeel that you get from it is really nice, and it also, when you look at the nib for what it is and not its application to bars and sauces and stocks and jus, you really start to see, you're like, you know what, I could use this in a savory fashion. It's very easy to see the translation, especially when you're eating the nib and you have it physically in front of you.
Ava, I wanted to ask you now about, you know, you're sampling all of this. You have a lot of experience with this when you did the chocolate trail. Tell us a little bit about what's out there in Dubai. You know, today we're talking about Cocoa Kitchen. We have Bacon Spice as well. But you went out and you researched. I use the word research. You had fun, tasted.
We ate a lot.
Yes.
Research, I like that.
Yeah.
What is
we do a lot of research, in fact.
What are the chocolate makers out there in Dubai?
I mean, we were, to be honest, we were very, very focused on one chocolate maker in Barsha, and that was Cocosia. So we sort of were really just focused on what she was doing. We weren't going around and actually exploring all of the different chocolate offerings. But I've seen a lot of a lot of chocolate makers that have imported their products. So some of my favorite chocolate brands, for example, from New York, people have their favorite brands from Paris, have made their way into City Walk. So you know, from a time when we're on the tours, we pass by in Dera, we pass by the shop, which is called Pachi, which used to be the only gourmet chocolate that was available back in the 80s. And people always look at it and they see this fancy shop. They're like, what is this? And I said, well, this is the chocolate that you would give people if you, you know, wanted to really give a special gourmet gift. And even now people still do that. But now we have, you know, it's exploded. Everything from chocolate rooms to chocolate bars to specialty boutique chocolate shops to chocolate dessert cafes. But I mean, there's nothing, I think, like the kind that Chef has been showing us right now. It's always been chocolate in its sweetest, most Instagrammable format to date.
Yeah.
So it's really refreshing to see this sort of change. This is new.
I want to talk now to you, Chef, about where, you know, we've talked about origin, and I want to talk about where and who is, you know, collecting our chocolate, because there's a lot of articles out there that talk about the bittersweet toil of chocolate and how you see a lot of child labor, and 10 dirhams a day they get paid to supply some of the chocolate bars that we're eating, and we have no idea, or maybe we haven't thought about it. But you've been to some of these farms before, and I remember you telling me a little bit about how amazing it was to go and actually visit it, go to the origin.
Yeah, sure. Well, obviously, chocolate makers are starting to look into how chocolate's grown more these days, organically and mass-produced as well. But when I had my experience, I was on St. Lucia in the Caribbean Islands, amazing destination, and I actually walked through this cocoa plantation. And they weren't certified organic, but they had all organic practices, where the farmers would ferment chili, ginger, and garlic in big pots to throw over the plants so it would fight insects and rats and things like that.
That was their pesticide.
That was their pesticide. Mm. Okay. And a lot of science goes behind chocolate these days. Obviously, a lot of chocolate plants aren't grown by seed anymore. They're grafted. So you take a young tree and then you'd graft another tree onto it, so you would actually get your chocolate harvest quicker. So behind this, with practices with, you know, child labor, yes, it happens, you know, and it's sad to say, but it happens in all industries as well.
Yes.
But then you look where chocolate is growing, it's growing along the equator, along these more, you know, not so fortunate countries as well. And, you know, the company I worked with, they were giving back to the community. They were actually building a chocolate factory on the island. So they weren't exporting cocoa beans, which are very light and very cheap. They would make their own chocolate and then sell the expensive product.
So how can we make sure, you know, that we know when we're biting into that bar of chocolate, if, you know, if we want to make sure where it's come from, how do we go about, you know, and also what we were talking about earlier about, are they telling us the truth on the label of where this is coming from?
Obviously, you know, if you have a passion for food, you do your research with anything. You know, where does my tomatoes come from? Where does my celery come from? Where does my chocolate come from? You know, am I getting salt from a good source, or is it panned by a child? You know, what we were touching about. It's, you know, the information is out there, you know, it's just people's got to research a little bit more to find out, you know, if you do have that passion, you will research it and you will actually pick up that correct product then.
Now I want to move to another tasting, but very, very sweet. And it's probably the most, one of the most iconic dishes that people, I don't know many people that don't love a chocolate brownie.
Completely.
It's coming around,
so
guys.
It's coming over to Andre.
Oh, it's nice and fudgy and thick. I love it.
Ava is going to try it, even though she's...
I am going to try it.
Yeah. So tell me about your chocolate brownie, James.
Okay. So obviously, I've been cooking for many, many moons. And sometimes you just can't change a recipe. So this is based on one of the first brownie recipes ever made. So when we make our chocolate brownie, we use pure pure chocolate, not cocoa powder, as our base. And we use milk chocolate in there. So that's the Papua New Guinean milk chocolate as the little pellets in the back. And then we use our 70% Caribbean chocolate as our melted chocolate within the brownie. And we don't overcook it. You know, it's not like a cake.
Yeah,
you
let's talk about the texture, because often I think with a chocolate brownie, sometimes it's, you know, it's overwhelmed with the, you know, maybe it's the chocolate sauce, or it's just too dense. Yours is very sort of light. I don't know.
Well, thank you. It's been stuck in a backpack bag and it got compressed a little but I'll take that.
But listen, okay, hold on one second. If you blindfold, brownies are meant to be eaten, you know, indulgently in your bed while no one's watching. Everyone knows that. But seriously, this is a totally satisfying classic take on a great brownie. I mean, it's funny because despite working in fancy kitchens, I think these are the desserts, I mean, that appeal to me the most because they're simple. The outside texture of the brownie has got that nice kind of crusty flavor, but the inside's still fudgy and soft. And what I like about this brownie is you can still taste chunks of chocolate in it.
That's what I like.
Which is, that's my thing, because I don't want to just have this completely, sorry to say it, but a Starbucks brownie where it's just, you know, it's just kind of a mush ball that's been over refrigerated. Yeah.
Agreed. I think that's what was different. I'm not a fan of nuts in brownies. I'm not a walnut brownie kind of person.
None of that.
And so initially when I started to bite and I was like, oh, that feels like a walnut. And then it suddenly just broke out into chocolate. And I've never really had.
By the way, guys, everyone, hashtag, it's a walnut is my new favorite thing
right,
today.
But the walnut was, it was a piece of chocolate, I've never really had a fudgy brownie with actual, you know, whole bits of chocolate in there. And that was delicious.
Well, it's an indulgence of chocolate, isn't it? That's what it's supposed to be.
Guess the ingredient.
We have one more clue if you want to get into the draw to get that 500 dirham voucher to go and visit Coco Kitchen. It is the final clue today and Ava has it.
Today's mystery ingredient has a savory and sweet taste with just the right amount of twang and is slathered and squirted onto our favorite foods. Every year, Americans purchase 10 billion ounces of today's mystery ingredient. And it is also an ingredient in Chef James' cocoa powder smoky barbecue sauce.
Just a couple more minutes we have left, and our conversation today has been all around savory chocolate. My guests have been Ava from Firing Pan Adventures, Andre from Baker and Spice, and we also have head chef James McDonald. He is from Coco Kitchen. And every week we ask our guests that come into studio, we ask them this:
food fantasy.
So this is your ultimate food fantasy. You work with it every day. You're the expert behind it, chef. But what to you would be the ultimate food fantasy?
I have actually two food fantasies.
Okay, two of them.
My first one is air-dried beef. Like, I do it at home. I do the practice this at home as well. The time that goes behind it, 45 days of waiting for a whole strip line to age and then butchering it at the end and having a product that's lost moisture and gained flavor is amazing. And then you offer that to your friends as a steak to come around to your house.
Oh, yeah.
Like, literally, we all just like, it's like we party to the steak.
To the steak.
Oh, and it's amazing. And it's something you can't find in Dubai. So that's why I'm doing it at my house at the moment. And like, a lot of my friends are enjoying it.
You're doing this at your house. What is your wife thinking about this?
It's okay. obviously, I have a spare room to stink out. And
you're using a whole room in your house for your food fantasy.
Why not?
Okay. So that's food fantasy number one.
Yeah. My second one is obviously it happens at a festive time around Christmas time, around December. And it's Vacheron cheese.
Oh, yeah.
It only comes out at Christmas time, around December. January, it's better, as you get that piney flavor. You take that top layer of mold off, and then you've just got creamy gooiness at the bottom. And the earthy textures, the flavors of this, of like the pine and the soft mold on top. And literally, that on toast, or that just on a spoon, is...
On a spoon.
It only happens once a year, though. That's the thing.
I grew up actually doing, we do it in puff pastry, and we bake the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you bake an entire wheel of cheese, and then you finish it off, and then that goes real quick.
That's the bomb. Yeah.
So two food fantasies for Chef today. Now, we've had the mystery ingredient running throughout the show, and Andre and Ava have been giving us clues. And I'm going to announce the winner now, because we have this mystery ingredient in one of the recipes that Chef has given us. Those are up on the Dubai Today blog if you want to go and check them out. And it's in Chef's cocoa powder smoky barbecue sauce. And today we're talking about tomato ketchup.
Yes.
That's the answer of the mystery ingredient today. Congratulations to Mark. You are the winner. You're going to get that 500 dirham voucher to go to Coco Kitchen. But tell us a little bit about, because I think I haven't met many chefs who are, you know, I don't know, are you making your own tomato ketchup? But a lot of people put their nose up at ketchup.
No, sorry, straight out of bottles. You know, it's some really? Things you just can't change. Yeah. Okay, you can be fancy and make a tomato salsa or your own coarse tomato ketchup. But sorry, I grew up with it out of a bottle. Sometimes you just can't change that. You know, in certain areas, okay, I've worked in Michelin star restaurants. I would never serve Heinz ketchup on the table in a Michelin star restaurant. But then if I'm down at my local burger place or down at the diner, I would want to see ketchup on the table.
This is probably a good point to say Baker & Spice makes their own ketchup. So I guess I'm the snob in the room. But
but who of us didn't grow up dipping our fries or whatever it would be in ketchup? Didn't you say, Ava, you grew
everything.
Up?
Everything. Yeah. I mean, if my family's listening to this right now, they're probably in splits because I was ketchup over everything. It was always, at least I can say I had preferences. It was Heinz over Hunt's any day. But yeah, it was ketchup on ketchup, and condiment sandwiches are a thing.
Ketchup on ketchup.
But I do, and it was funny because I was talking to Joe about this earlier as well, is that you either grow up in a mayonnaise home or you grow up in a ketchup home. And I grew up in a mayonnaise home. Like, we just didn't do that. Is that blasphemous?
I've changed. I grew up in Ketchupville, and I went over to Mayonnaiseville.
Oh, I love it. Welcome.
So. We called it, we never called it ketchup. The first time I heard about it was, you know, when we were in the States, because I grew up in South Africa and Zimbabwe. We called it tomato sauce.
Yeah, in Australia we do as well.
Tomato sauce.
It sounds more refined.
What was this
when
ketchup
there.
Thing they're yeah. talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. We used to be called catsup, right?
Catsup, is that yeah, what the, that's, the, and then the it became eventually. But I do think the ketchup over the years has become sweeter, or maybe my palate has just become
No, for sure.
Summer, right?
And now they have organic Heinz 50, all this crazy stuff. Yeah.
I feel like it might be like a... where it's made in the world. Like sometimes, you know, when they say the chocolate is different, yeah, you know, your favorite bar of chocolate, when I moved from South Africa to here, it's definitely different. So I don't know if it's just where they're making
could
it.
Be, could
it
be.
Could be. All right, well, we're running out of time, but I do want to say thank you to Head Chef James McDonald. He's from Coco Kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us today. Are you doing anything special at the moment?
At the moment, we're working on a few things, changing the menu, bits and bobs like that. Always doing things in our kitchen. Obviously, we're using an exciting product like cocoa nibs and chocolate, so we're always just changing things around there. So, yeah.
Ava from Frying Pan Adventures has also been one of my guests today. Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us, are you doing anything special at the moment?
Yes. So literally as of day before, we taste tested, ran with an Emirati interactive cooking demo. For the past 4 years, I've been looking for some sort of instructional session where people can learn, whether residents or tourists can learn about how to cook Emirati food, interact with Emirati spices, and
That's
have
amazing.
An authentic Emirati lunch. And I think we have finally found the chef. We finally found the restaurant which can do it for us. So I'm really, really excited. And it's just, I mean, I literally sat up last night listing it up on the website. So it won't be long before we list it up soon.
And Andre, what's happening with Baker & Spice?
I mean, we're in the midsummer months, so we're kind of just incubating, but we're getting ready for the farmers market, which is a big thing for us during the winter season, which is a lot of fun for everyone. And it's one of the only places you can buy directly from actual UAE local organic certified farmers. So I'm getting pumped for that.
I will second that.
All my guest details are up on the Dubai Today blog if you want to find out anything about them. We also have the recipe that Chef James has very kindly sent to us. Also, I think some lots of pictures and stuff on Facebook, social media today. Thank you to everyone that's been in touch with the show today. Lots of text messages coming in. We really appreciate that.